Okay, so this is sort of my public speaking debut, you know, to hold the floor for so long, so, oh, pretty amazing you all hang around. Okay, just want to talk a bit about why Australia is a bit different.
Drains circle counterclockwise.
Hey, but the light switches are really interesting. I thought that your light switches went a different way from ours. But they go the same way, but you're just pointing, you've got, just got your legs pointing in the different direction. Hey?
On your map, is Antarctica at the top?
Yes. No, 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 of course not. Okay, Australia, I design wooden boats that sail fast. Bit, or more of an emphasis on performance and the other benefits that it brings. Someone else who does that also really well is Ian Outhred, or Outhred. Outhred.
Is that how you say it?
I don't know.
That's how they say it in Australia.
I met somebody who actually talked to him.
Yes.
He said Outhred.
How is it?
But that guy was a Dutchman, and so who knows what.
Ah, yeah. Oot, oot. Yeah, like one of my friends has met him too. He came over for a Goolwa, one of the wooden boat festivals at Goolwa, and he always corrects himself to say Outhred. But Ian's a person who also designs boats that go really, really well, and his, the thing that he added to them was to make them a lighter weight as well. You know, because he's taken very classically traditional boats that pulled the weight out. He's also Australian.
He lives in Scotland. That's probably where you're confused.
No, no, no. No, that was Phil Bolger who died. He was alive when I left Australia because Duck Flat, who are my agents, are his agents as well. Yeah, and they'd been speaking to him. So he grew up in Australia racing boats as well. The thing that sort of happened with there's something that didn't happen in Australia that happened in the rest of the world. First of all, we're really crazy about boats with big sail areas that go really fast. The second thing that we're quite crazy about is keeping the weight right down. All racing people are like that. But the thing that happened in Australia is that we've got a small population. So when you guys made the transition to fiberglass, we didn't. All our small boats kept being built in plywood, so the technology kept developing right up to the beginning of the 1980s. At the beginning of the 1980s, then a lot of the classes, the racing classes, started moving over to foam fiberglass, because you can make foam fiberglass lighter than timber. You can't make, or lighter and stiffer than timber, somewhat delicate though, but solid fiberglass just can't compete with timber in terms of stiffness and strength. Just because it's so heavy, it's got to be made a lot thinner, and if it's thinner, it's going to be more flexible.
You know, why didn't you make the transition to fiberglass?
We don't have a big enough market to afford the tooling. Someone does the tooling and they're going to go broke.
You still had forests left.
No, we also got rid of them.
The issue was amortizing the tooling costs over enough of a production run. There wasn't enough of a market to justify that size production run for the tooling, so they just never did it.
Yeah, or it happened to a limited extent. And the boats that were built in fiberglass to compete against plywood boats just weren't particularly competitive. And the only way that they could compete was to go to foam fiberglass. We were one of the first countries to go to foam fiberglass for boat building, for performance boat building. And with foam fiberglass, you've got so many variables, you can outperform any other solid material. So that meant that wooden boats couldn't compete at all. So we lost our wooden boat tradition, apart from a few classes that said that you either had to use wood or solid fiberglass, or that they were mostly owner-built, so they were bent towards that direction anyhow. Just last year, the last class in which wooden boats are more competitive than fiberglass boats, they finally developed a fiberglass boat that was more competitive than the home-built wooden ones. So now, instead of that class costing about $3,500 to get into. It's another $9,000 to $10,000 boat. It's so short-sighted. Like, who do you blame about, you know, how the cost has gone up for racing classes? No one could see it was coming, and no one quite realised that
speed,
it was...
Speed cost, how fast do you want
to
go?
Yeah, speed cost. And some of the classes tried to restrict it too, like the boat that turned into the Taser racing dinghy, it's called the NS-14, and I used to race them for many years, and they had a rule that no updated technology for a single component could increase the price by 20%. 1 year, someone turned up to a regatta with a mast with above the hands changed over to carbon fibre. The rest was aluminium. It was only 20%. The next year, someone turned up with two-thirds of the mast in carbon fibre. It's only 20%. Yeah, it's an arms race. It really is. And some of the things we've done, like with the puddle duck rules, one of the nice things you can do with puddle ducks is there are six really basic rules which define the shape of the bottom and also get rid of some features such as hydrofoils so the boat can sit above the water, right? The rules are very, very sort of very, very basic. But within the rules, you can create new subclasses. And when I designed the Oz version, I created a subclass at the same time. The subclass says you have to use polytarp sails. And that means that instead of a sail, every other class, to get the best sail, you've got to go to a sail maker. The sail's going to be Dacron or one of the other, you know, fabulous materials now. And for something like the puddle duck, particularly with the size of the sail that we're carrying, it's going to cost you $500 or $600 in Australia. We just said polytarp. Why didn't we allow second-hand sails within the subgroup of the PD Racer? Within the general group, you can carry whatever sail you like. There's no restriction at all. But within the Oz subgroup, you can't use second-hand sails because that's another arms race. I can buy a sail that's 5 years old for $50. But someone who's got a sail that's 3 years old will beat me, and they're paid a bit more. So the least second-hand sail will be the fastest sail. So instead of paying $500 or $600 for a new sail, the price for the class sails is pegged at the highest second-hand price you can pay. The other nice thing about making your own sails, and the full instructions are in the plan, is, as all the puddle duck people know, it's really empowering. Because sails are actually quite simple, particularly the way that we make them. With traditional sails, they have broad seaming, which means that when you, most of you probably know what broad seaming is, when you have a sail, there are two ways to get some depth into the sail. One is to cut it with some curve along the edges, like we saw here with the mast bend. The other way is to tease these seams in the body of the sail slightly closer together.
Each seam in the body of the sail has a curved edge, and this of course adds a lot of labour.
Right, and that creates extra stress as well. But if you don't have broad seams, it means you can just get a big huge piece of polytarp, cut it with the curve for the luff, and that's really the only shaping you have to do to make the sail actually work. So it's incredibly simple. Just provide the reinforcement for eyelets to lash the sail on. We didn't allow mast tracks because the nicest mast track in Australia costs $20 a metre, $20 a yard. You know, so there are all these ways prices can creep up. The other way that boat prices have crept up are all the fittings and so on. So we've limited the mechanical advantage of any block and pulley system or any lever or whatever to 3-to-1. So you can't have these multiple cascades of blocks and pulleys, which also force you to have the expensive ball bearing blocks and so on. So the puddle ducks are rigged with about, well, I'll talk Australian prices. You use $10 blocks and you need maybe 4 or 5 of them if you're buying full chandlery rate. with a modern race boat, one type I used to sail, the lightweight Sharpie, which is similar to a 505 in complexity, they pay usually $4,000 for fittings alone, you know, and the little kids' boats that I was talking about costing $7,500, well, they're probably investing about $1,000 on ball bearing fittings and so on. So they're good things to keep out of the equation when you're thinking of new classes. So go back to Australia, just some boat examples. The boat that used to be raced in the Olympics, the Flying Dutchman, the whole weight of that is 320 pounds. Our closest similar design is a lightweight Sharpie. That's 170 pounds. 320 versus 170. For one of the first plywood boats was a New Zealander, or modern plywood boats, called John Spencer, a really underestimated designer. A lot of thinking, like, Australia is really good at picking up ideas from New Zealand and saying they're Australian ideas. But John Spencer was at the front of this revolution at the same time as Van Stad in Holland. He was pushing very light plywood boats as well. But Spencer designed a little 12-foot boat for kids in 1959 called the Cherub. It's 110 pounds. 12 feet, 110 pounds. Our weight tend to average about 10 pounds per foot of length for dinghies. I remember when the 420 dinghy came out, and I remember they tried to use the advertising they used in America, saying that it was lightweight. We fell about laughing because the 420 is 220 pounds compared to the 120 pounds that we were expecting for a boat of that size. And that nature. The International 14 has been one of the major classes, world sort of prestige classes for open boat racing, and it's a long history. The International 14, I wasn't able to find what the old hull weight was, but I think it was around 350 pounds. Our 14 footers are all around 10 pounds a foot, 140 pounds, totally reliable. The boats will have two good racing seasons, and then someone not so good will pick them up. And with the older boat building methods of non-epoxy, they sort of have a few leaks by the time they're a couple of years old, so you could pick them up more or less and still race them for another 2 or 3 years. So the boats were durable at those sort of hull weights. The thing that happened after you guys and most of the Northern Hemisphere moved to glass fibre is that epoxy started in on the scene in Australia. And we found that rather than the plywood boat starting to become a bit less reliable and so on after a couple of years, is the reliability just continues all the way through. That the boat will never develop leaks, never have any substantial structural problems.
Well, that isn't entirely true, one of the popular classes here is the thistle. The fiberglass thistles so often have trouble with the hull shape after being race marked.
Showed
up for a friend of mine, John, just before they had the national championship in my part of Oregon a few years ago. And I wanted my friend to smooth out the bottom and just all lumps and hollows and so on. The fiberglass ones do wear out too.
Yeah, the fiberglass ones do wear out, and often they can't meet their own weight standards. You know, like the Olympic 470 was really plagued with very short durabilities, that people would race them for 6 months before they started getting a bit slower. And they addressed that by going to foam glass and increasing the cost yet again. Yeah, so epoxy got rid of all the major problems for the wooden boats, the wooden race boats in Australia. And the reliability of the wooden boats, even pre-epoxy, was quite good. We had a message on the Australian Woodwork Forum today that when Ian Outhred was in Outhred, was in Australia. He used to race a class called Gwen 12, which was one of the first plywood boats designed in Australia and might have been one of the very first plywood racing dinghies in the world, 12 feet long, and someone reported that they had bought his boat, the boat that he won the national championships with, 12 years later, and they said it didn't leak a drop. I imagine that Mr. O was as good at woodwork then as he is now, so all the joints were really good and so on. So the non-gap-filling traditional glues did a really good job. So the boat was very, very sound. Yeah, that's just new news to me too. One of the things, as you all know, the other good thing about epoxy is that it allows, because so many of the skills have been lost, well, we don't have the skills to do the tight joins, epoxy makes it a little bit less hassle. But I think you all know that very well. I'll talk about rigs for a little while, and then we'll call it a day, unless I can think of something else.
Let me go back to fiberglass and cloth for a minute. You've heard the story about us bashing the Goat Island skiff about it, Timothy Lake, and our struggle with trying to decide what to do with it. And the way I've come around to think about it and to understand it is that the fiberglass cloth has, instead of epoxy or any resin, has a high tensile strength, but not so much compressive strength. Is that correct?
No. When it's glued to a substrate or thick enough, the compression and tensile strengths are pretty much the same in an engineering sense.
What about the polyester cloths?
Polyester, I don't know actually. I don't know. They don't add much strength to the structure anyhow because they stretch relatively easily. So by the time the wood's about to rupture, they're not actually carrying much load, which is one of the plus points about them. I don't like them because they're so bloody hard to sand and because they don't add strength to the structure. The only cloth that has I know of that has a really significant difference between tensile and compressive strength is Kevlar. So Kevlar has a very high tensile strength, but its compression strength is not much better than glass. So if you're putting it in a compressive stress situation, you may as well save your money and just use plain glass, and that was common for race boats. What were you thinking about the damage with the goat?
We were thinking if that was true, then we might use fiberglass patches at the breeches inside. The one I did, I showed you, and there was something just on the bottom on the outside.
Yeah, like the Zonol or whatever will stop a gouge. But it won't help it if you land on a rock. Yeah, the plywood will split just the same and not so much water will come in. So you've still got to repair. One of the areas where I've sort of been a bit instrumental is in saying that traditional rigs can perform very, very well indeed. This is reasonably well known amongst people who can really, really sail and who are open-minded, because the principles for traditional rigs and modern rigs are exactly the same. The big problem with, or the biggest performance improvement for any rig is to control the twist of the sail. Like when we were talking about the mast bend, that you have the boom at that angle, the upper sail will be at, the boom is at one angle, the upper sail is at a slightly different angle.
And that angle will change with every gust.
For a boat to be efficient, the angle at the top
is generally 10 or 12 degrees wider compared to the boom.
It's quite close. But what you commonly see with traditionally rigged boats, or boats rigged by people who are learning to sail, is you might see that sort of situation, the top twists off.
Too much, maybe 20 or 30 degrees.
The control of that twist has been the single biggest improvement in performance in the past 100 years. And modern race boats make it an art form with particular controls like a boom vane. A boom vane just to stop the boom from raising up, and that'll stop the sail from twisting. That needs to be quite powerful. Like they talk about, like they sell in channelries in Australia, they sell these little 3-to-1 jihikis with a built-in cleat. It's a little bit useful. But when you start, when you go to a greater purchase and say have 8-to-1 or 12-to-1 or 15-to-1, you really start to get quite amazing benefits from it. Now, you don't use it so much, so strong in light winds, but as soon as the wind starts piping around, if you have a bendy mast like we talked about before, it gives you a huge performance boost. I don't like it. The reason I don't like it is purely expense. Well, by the time you're up around 10 to 1 or 12 to 1, you need all the ball bearings, you need meters of low stretch cord, you need all sorts of bits and pieces. It also starts to be an important thing to let off at the right time, because you can do damage if you, sometimes if you change the point of sail, and it pushes the, like when it's all aligned in the centre line, it's just pushing the mast forward and the mast is generally happy with that. But when it goes out to 90 degrees on some boats, it's pushing the boat to the middle of the mast sideways, and that can be quite spectacular. But that stops the boom from rising by providing a tension underneath with the lovely old crystal.
It's self-banging.
There's tension there, the boom can't go anywhere. So you just need a snotter at the front which provides enough tension. With a 2 to 1 or 3 to 1 snotter, you, in light or moderate winds, you can just use moderate tension. In stronger winds, be completely brutal. Like, just go animal with the thing. And you'll find that the boat is a lot more controllable. One of the big disadvantages of twist is that when you're heading downwind,
the boom will be square to the boat, but the top of the sail twists well forward.
The top of the sail can easily twist out like that if you've got not much banging effect. And what happens then is the force is that way. And when the force is that way, but you ease it too far forward and the sail twists, and the force is suddenly reversed, so you're expecting the boat to heel to leeward, but it heels to windward, which is the side you're sitting on already, and you just watch the whole thing go over, and you're not able to do anything. With commercial sailing boats and fishing boats and so on, that's something that they normally solve with some sort of handy billy that's just a temporary thing. But the modern boom bang means that you can trim the sail to any point and control the twist. The spritsail does the same thing, but learn to be brutal with it.
Just to be clear, I mean the triangular leg of mutton sail with a sprit boom.
The other rig that deals with twist reasonably well, not quite as well as the sprit rig, is the balanced lug, which is my favourite rig. Because you have a downhaul here that pulls down, which means there's tension in both sides of the sail.
Front and back edges of the sail.
Balance that pull in the middle of the boom. So that restricts the twist. It's not as effective as that, but it's quite simply achieved. If you've got a balanced lug rig, you need not too much tension in light winds. As soon as the wind gets a little bit stronger and the boat's nicely powered up, you put quite a lot of tension into it. When you're starting to have a little bit too much power to hold the boat up easily, just go animal with the tension. You know, like whatever you can get into it will be a good thing. And you'll find that the boat responds really well.
What do you use
on the balanced lug? We use the balanced lug.
Right.
Yeah.
And the downhill on that, again, is in the spirit of minimal expansion and maximum simplicity, is just a cord that goes up around the boom at the mast, and it attaches it as well.
So even though there are frictional losses, nominally it's 6 to 1, right? And the thing is to be completely brutal with it as soon as there's much wind.
My only complaint is that.
Yeah. Why not?
And what bridge is on
the
PD Racer? Same thing. Yeah. The PD Racer actually has two available rigs. One's the Sprit one, or my version of the PD Racer has two available rigs. It comes with a Sprit rig, because that's just so simple for rigging, for sail making, everything. But there's the option of a lug rig, and someone just emails me and I'll send them the details of that. The balanced lug, yeah.
I want something about the sprit sail. That isn't really a sprit sail. Sprit sail, a sprit like a button. It's an incredibly docile sail.
Mm.
Well, Sage has one of those, and I can just whack off the sheet and she'll lay there, beam onto the wind.
Yeah, exactly.
The sail feather-greening out, and it's not clogging. The brick room controls it so well. So I just flash a little bit, and I do whatever I want to do and pull on the sheet, and away I go. My little Joe Box Junior. Bird-watching captain boat.
Yeah.
And because the sheet only has to pull the sail in and out, it doesn't have to hold the sail down.
Right.
It's a very light sheeting.
Phil
Bolger is as buddies with that big on lots of boats.
Well, he's the one who opened my eyes up to it. Yeah, but we don't have that tradition.
How ultimately who you.
Yeah.
But how much money you spent to go as fast as you do.
Yeah, well, I think if you can go as fast as you do and not spend much money and beat everyone else, that's even more satisfying.
Yeah, that's
the best of both worlds.
Yeah, but the simplicity of that sprit boom legged button is just wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. The downside of the sprit is the reefing.
Yes, of course.
That's fiddly, and that's why I tend to prefer the balanced lug.
How do you reef that sprit?
The sprit's all, you can reef it, but it's a bit fiddly. That one's a bit fiddly, that one can be...
Well, one just like that, what you do is you, to lower the sail, you have to get it past where the snotter is attached, which means you have to disconnect the snotter, lower the sail, and reconnect the snotter. Which is rather awkward. On some boats, that snotter could be quite high up.
You can get around that with a track, but then a track is more expensive.
Yeah, it's a jam. I don't like track. But I do have one on Sage, because it's the only way to be able to reef easily.
Yeah.
I understand. But when I built mine for this little... I built the Summer Breeze, which won a Duckworks contest a few years ago.
Oh, okay.
Get under the Oregon law about having the license for sailboats.
I see.
You can build a sailboat 12 foot, and you really want to pay the permit. And so I took a balance rating. All I did was put it up about 2 foot, 3 feet above
the
button boom, and then bring it down. So I didn't say that.
With sprit, it's a bit of a hassle, and that's the downside of wishbone rigs too, with the basic sprit with two sides. Some sizable yachts have been done with the wishbone. I've sailed on them, and they're cows to reef as well. Yeah. But if you're going to rig a balanced lug, I've got perhaps the best resource available on setting them up on my website. I've got a method for the halyards that will never jam. It will also, Bolger's biggest, this is one where I've outlearned Bolger. He says one of the problems with the balanced lug is when you slack off the halyard, the back end of the yard hangs down into the boat and will clonk someone on the head and make it difficult to drop the sail completely. That doesn't happen with my version. Just like the rudder I stole from the Paper Tiger catamaran, another New Zealand design. Lovely little lightweight plywood cap. I snaffled it. Same with the halyard system. I snaffled that from Dixon Kemp's Manual of Seamanship, which was printed in 1870. Nothing new under the sun, and all the problems have been worked out. So, yeah, I didn't know about Dixon Kemp's at all. I was just building my best sailing canoe, which is, for those of you who don't know, it's 16 feet long, 32 inches wide. It's a plywood box in the middle. It's got two masts, both balanced lugs, and carries some 85 square feet of sail area. So it's quite a powerful little beast. But I was building that and heart-aching about how to do the halyard. Like, the normal method is to have the halyard go to the top of the mast, it's tied off on the yard. It's when you slack off the halyard, it twists the loop, and then the whole lot jams. But Dixon Kemp has this lovely method where the halyard goes up the mast to the top. There's a block on the yard, and the halyard goes down through that block, and then it goes to the front end of the boom, but on the opposite side to the yard. So the mast is between the yard and the halyard. So as soon as there's tension on the halyard, the yard has to stay right beside the mast. They just can't get away from each other.
Tied to the tip of the yard?
Yes, tied to the front of the yard.
It goes up to the block, goes up to the top.
Yeah, so the mast is in the middle, the yard is on one side, and that rope is going on the opposite side of the mast.
And how to keep that yard at the proper percentage?
I don't know, it just happens.
Is that right?
Yeah, you just put the block in the middle of the yard.
You guess the location of the block on the yard,
yeah.
and that block is put on there not by screwing it on or whatever. It's, there's a loop of rope on there, and you use that rope to put a cow hitch in, and you just cinch it down, and that's the new location.
So therefore,
you decide to slack it and move it up or down.
So
the yard.
When you pull it up, I mean, I've read that you wanted about 30 to 33% somewhere in there up on that yard. That's right.
No, I use that goes on about halfway.
Well, no, I mean where you want the yard to be crossing the mast.
I don't use any figure. I just do what looks good. What looks good to me is, of course, I've looked at lots of old photos. You know, so I'm slightly suspicious of percentage rules, or way suspicious of percentage rules, because you know, like you look at lots of older stuff, and often you find that there are cases when they're quite out. You know, like one of the really classic things, actually this goes back to performance as well, is that someone once wrote that your centerboard area should be 4% of your sail area, right? And it's a load of crap. The reason it's a load of crap is that what you get from the centerboard depends on how fast you're going. So if your boat's really slow, you need more centerboard. If your boat's really fast, you don't need quite as much centerboard for the sail area. So I've found with my range of boats that a centerboard that is about 3 feet deep in the water and about 10 inches or a foot wide will do for every boat from 8 feet to about 16 feet. If a 16-foot boat is particularly slow, then the board will need to be bigger. But 3 feet by 1 feet or a little bit narrower will do for every size of boat in that range. And that's the single biggest reason why most traditional boats and most semi-amateur designed boats don't perform very well. It's because that centerboard is just that little bit too small. Like
that brings up an interesting point then about a big board, because on one hand you're going to get more in the water and
the other
you're not.
Yeah,
so
do you
not like big boards for that reason? Both or can you use them all?
Yeah, but I've got nothing against lee boards except they're slightly lower performance. But if you've got really shallow water, they're a great solution. You know, because to go sailing with a less efficient setup is better than not going sailing at all.
They also take the board out of the middle of the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's why I did that.
You just chose to do that, or the
first? For the original Puddle Duck Racer, there's no foils specified.
So you can do whatever you want.
Oh, whatever you want.
So I did the Oz rudder blade, and I did design my own lee board / rowing board.
And your lee board doesn't go from side to side. You keep it on one side.
No, I just keep it on one side.
Yeah.
Mine has a
recess point there
for this boat I built.
Yep.
You know, I know that Folger does it all the time, and but what you're saying there is that you know, there are times when that center board is not going to work as well.
Well, I think look, just from puddle duck racing and using boats with lee boards and so on, is if up to 16 feet, you just keep that rule of having 3 feet below the bottom of the boat when it's upright by a foot or slightly less wide, it'll work fine on both tacks. You know, that the degree of immersion isn't enough to make a really big difference usually. Small light boats are almost always more efficient when you sail them upright anyhow. So if you sail it over really heavily heeled with the board on the windward side, you'll probably move out of it. My Oz version of the PD Racer has a central centerboard, and the reason I chose to do that was that I was designing the best possible boat I could, and the centerboard is more efficient.
Terminology terminology. Are you talking centerboard or deck?
Okay, this is an Australian versus American problem. Centerboard is anything in the middle of the boat.
No, no. Centerboard is what rotates up.
No.
Falls.
It's just says it doesn't.
Centerboard is the one that you insert in the slot.
It doesn't say. Oh, you see, what you're talking about is a dagger board and a swinging center board.
On the odd PDR, you have a dagger board or a swinging center board.
Yeah, it's a center board which is a dagger.
I have a spritz on my little wear, and I'm wondering if the same.
You mean a spritzel like this?
No, it's a real spritzel. It's like the balanced lug, except it's got a spritzel going up to the high.
Oh, yeah. The full-sided
exactly.
Spritz.
Yep.
Yeah, sorry.
A real spritzel.
Ah, what am I doing? Yeah. With that, and that's the spritzel there. Okay. That's what I meant.
It comes all the way down. I mean, yours is pretty far down.
How long is it?
3 feet. It's a weight where.
One thing you have to be careful with on a loose boat sail, and on a short boat, you can run into a
Yeah, like that's a really, exactly. It's got a lot of twist, and also any sail without a boom, you rely on shitting it at that angle. And that means that two counterproductive things happen. When you're heading downwind, you have to back off the sheet and you end up with gobs of twist, like a huge amount of twist. The other thing is when you're heading upwind in a bit of a blow, boat's all nicely balanced, going well, gust comes. So what do? You ease the sail. And that makes the sail fuller, develops more power, and it staggers for a moment, so you have to let go quite a lot of sheet. If you're having problems with that, then the boom will help.
The other thing is the light wind. Light wind, there's no way of getting that sail, the bottom of the sail out.
That's right, and then you rely on the twist to get some air at the top of the sail. Well, my take on the situation, like, the wonderful thing about this rig is the spars are so short, and also the rig is really, really simple to put up. Everything else is wrong. You know, it's crap to reef. Twist like crazy, and something else is wrong too. Yeah, and also it becomes a bag as soon as you ease off the sheet.
But there's a reason they call that a boom too.
Yeah, well, that's the sound it makes when it hits your head. But do you remember the early days of the Puddle Duck? There used to be huge hung, drawn and quartered battles about, I don't want to sail with a boom because it'll hit me in the head. And we don't have those conversations anymore. Because it's something that's very scary to a neophyte sailor. But after a year or two of experience, you know that it's not such a big deal. Yeah.
Even as clumsy a sailor as I am, I've never gotten smacked by a boom.
Yeah, I've been smacked by a Goat Island skiff boom, and I've been scalp-capped with the PD Racer boom too, and it just, ow! You know, and it's over. It's over. Oh. I'm going to remember to duck my head enough next time.
Because you sailed standing up.
Yeah, standing up. I hit myself in the knee.
Yeah, it doesn't take much of a move in something like yours to serve the proper function.
You know, when you say not much, what size you're talking about? Yeah, about a 3/4 inch square.
A bit bigger than that. Something that's, you know, maybe a 2-bit. A 2x2 that, you know, been planed around all around.
A sprit boom.
Low. Definitely.
Yeah. Two knotters in one boat.
The point is that this piece of wood is so cheap. You know, it's just one little bit of wood. You'll learn a lot if you get your piece of wood and try all configurations. See what you think of it.
Yeah.
You know, why not try? You know, and then you've got real knowledge rather than what someone's telling you on the wooden boat side. 3 hours. I'm just warming up. I'll make one summary comment. The Puddle Duck came from the Bulger Brick, which has higher top sides, and is rather known for being somewhat twist prone. the puddle duck is a refinement of that through Shorty Ralph Jr. Creating a class which can be low cost and has been responsible for getting, well, at least 330 new people on the water. Yeah, and most of them are in our age group sort of thing. People have always wanted to go sailing, and suddenly it's available. What I'm saying is that something that I understood when I saw the Bulger Brick for the first time, it's very much the shape of the PD Racer, but it's got quite a high top side. He's drawn an absolutely ginormous lee board on it. Almost that big. What do you reckon, John?
Well,
it's huge.
Maybe not that big.
Yeah, it's huge. It looks like the side profile of a Basset hound. Be a good paint skin. But the thing that made me realise, like, Bulger's boats are not slouches either. You know, they're very much focused at cruising, but they go very respectably. And the point comes back that the Oz PD Racer has a lot more performance, as we saw at the beginning, but the hull shape is not much different. It's just in the details of the rig, and it's in the details of the foils in the water. So it means that if you're designing a boat or working on a boat, you get those two components really right, and there are these huge benefits. Yeah, and it doesn't take a lot more extra time, but the benefits are there, and they're applicable to any boat just so easily. The wing in the air and the wing in the water.
And you've been talking about racing here, but I mean that boat.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So it goes back to those four lines. What was the four lines at the beginning?
All is points better than 45 degrees. Accelerates immediately. It goes where you point it, and it's less stressful to keep under control.
Can it be lifted on top of a car? What's yours weigh?
Well, you can lift it on the car. Scale. But the point is that it applies to any boat.
But I'm just thinking for your boat. I mean, I built my little under 12-foot boat for a couple of reasons. One, to teach myself to sail. One, because it was lightweight. And I didn't have a license and all that.
Yep.
But, I mean, how heavy is your...
The Oz PDR generally comes out around 60, 65 pounds.
Is that right?
Yeah. But...
You got plans with it?
No, you pay for them and they send them to you in an email.
Who's they?
Duckworks.
Oh.
I don't want to lift a finger. But can I go to the point that's on the first page of my website? I don't necessarily need you to buy one of my plans. The point is you've got a boat already. You know, do something really good with that boat. Get the Oz plans and apply the stuff there, because you'll be able to cut whatever outline of centerboard and rudder your boat has in the plan, make them 22 millimeters thick, and then you can apply the... Yeah, I always get a laugh out of people. And
I have nothing against millimeters, but I'm just...
Yeah. Yeah, but you can apply, you can use them to make the foils so that they're really effective. And it'll cost you a little bit of extra time, so it'll make the boat so much better. And also we use my rigging page, which is just free information for setting up the balance lug.
I went to your
page. Tell them how hard it is to find the one on rigging.
The page on rigging?
Yes.
Go to the front page of the site and then search for the word lug.
The profiles for your foils.
It was an Australian aerodynamicist called Neil Pollock. And he wrote a series of articles for Australian Nightline.
Good night, Lon.
See you next week.
Yeah, I'll see you on Tuesday.
Looking forward to it.
Okay,
it'll be great.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, and he did some work when personal computers first became powerful enough to actually set up a search program to find the optimum solution in certain scenarios. And the scenario he chose, one of the scenarios he chose, is lots of class racing boats say that you have to make the foils out of plywood of a specified thickness. Generally, a foil should be around, you know, if you've got a foil, that should be 10% of the overall length. That's the normal range. But he said, what if the class only allows plywood that thick? And he found an optimum solution for the front and the back. And that solution means that the middle part is parallel, front and back have some shape.
And this this foil shape actually serves the same purpose as a thicker shape.
It's a little bit less optimal, right? You'd lose some because it's thinner. But what you gain is that with the sizes of foils that we use on small boats, they really become quite thick quickly. Also, this wobbles around all over the place when you're trying to shave it. You get that side shaped, and then it's rolling all over the table and there's no reference point. So you'll build this type 10 times better and more accurately than you will build that one.
Because the flat middle section sits flat on your workbench.
So you lose, because it's a little bit less than optimal thickness, that saves you money, and also makes it lighter and so on. But it's more optimal because the shaping is more precise.
Yeah. And how scalable is that?
Completely scalable.
Right? You're a 22mm by 11-inch or whatever it is.
Yeah, so up to 16 feet goes on, skiff size, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Because it's strong enough for one person to get on top of to get the boat upside again.
But say you needed one that was 16 inches. You just scale it up directly, make it that much.
Yeah.
Make it a third longer and a third wider, and just scale it directly.
And it's not super critical either. You know, like if it doesn't quite... Like you're not trying to hit any precise numbers between there and there.
You can vary the width of the board by playing with the width of the flat area in the middle section.
Mm-hmm. Right, this space in the middle is a little bit flexible. The other place that it's more efficient too is that you have these two shaped parts.
That is the leading and trailing edge.
Like that. And what I've recently did with the Goat Island skiff foil, and certainly did with the Puffer Duck Racer foil, is the phrase Bolger uses, it penetrated my limited wit, that
simply by keeping those leading and trailing edges unchanged, but altering the width of the flat section in between them, this allows you to develop a more elliptically shaped tip without any extra difficulty of shaping.
So you've actually got a little bit more elliptically shaped foil, which is another advantage. By getting rid of that corner, that actually increases the performance, the efficiency a little bit.
Did you say you didn't put the corner on the OSPDR?
Yeah, I did put the corner on the OSPDR. That's the Goat Island skiff rudder.
I gave it a squared off elliptical tip.
Because it catches the shock cord at the right place, narrower than the box. So the tip of the blade's narrower than the box, so when you push it down, it pushes the shock cord out automatically. But I didn't realise that, I didn't initially realise that that also has a tip, so it's more hydrodynamically efficient. And that's it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, you've always been a wonderful audience. And I mean that. Very nice audience, thank you.
And your voice held out.
Yeah, I had hay fever that would have killed a brown dog and made a black dog sick.